During the break, nobody has asked to be opponent exauditorial. Anybody who wishes to do so should let me know now. Okay. I have a slight correction to make. The affiliation of the second opponent, Professor Junko Kitanaka, is Department of Human Sciences at the Faculty of Letters at the Keio University. So I'm sorry, we kind of placed you in a very strange department. We will now continue the public defense of the candidate's dissertation, and the candidate is requested to return to his place as soon as I leave it, and the second opponent to take her place. And I hereby yield the floor to the second opponent.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this wonderful occasion. I've never been to Norwegian defense before, and this is quite exotic for me. and I've been very much enjoying it. And I'd like to thank you for writing such a wonderful thesis. When I finished reading it, I felt both very happy and sad. Happy because, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to have helped supervise students from Ivy League schools and students from Europe, from top-tier schools. And I must say, this is one of the very best dissertations I've ever read. So it just gave me pleasure. I just couldn't stop reading it. And it's rare that happens. So I want to thank you for that. And I was also sad because I knew from reading this that you were planning to do field work in Japan. And because of what happened in Fukushima and the nuclear disasters afterwards, you couldn't make it there. And you were going to be affiliated at the medical school of Keio University, which is where I come from. So we could have been colleagues. And now we've lost a wonderful Japan scholar. So you're welcome to come and do research at Keio anytime in the future.
Thank you very much.
So with that, I'd like to start my comments and questions. Okay, so you don't mind if I sit down? So is that all right? Okay, thank you. And I think you wouldn't see me if I stand here. So. Okay. Yeah, what I really found it striking was the fact that what started out as this very applied project of, you know, looking at medical communication turned out to be something so philosophical, something so original, that I'm sure it very much exceeded the expectation of the people who invited you in the first place. So no wonder there were some tensions there. And I like to address some of that as ethical issues at the end. But I basically have three points and questions to make. And partly because I like to find ways for you to expand on those three themes, because I think that these themes, three themes will become three very important articles in medical anthropology that will be cited by many. And they really must be read because they're wonderful, wonderful papers, I think. They have to do, first of all, with the semiotics of the bio, and secondly, medical communication, and thirdly, the anthropology of scientific knowledge production. So I'll start with the very first one. And here, it's not so much a question as it is a comment and a request to elaborate a little bit on some of the aspects. What I found fascinating was this, the semiotics of bio that you start out the book with, I mean, the dissertation with, is really ingenious because you're writing from Norway, which is, you know, in the first world, with the second most expensive living standard, I think, in the whole world, with the cutting-edge scientific knowledge and, you know, cutting-edge scientific practices. And you're dealing with this Swedish woman. And here I wasn't really sure if there was something implicit going on between this Swedish woman who's problematic and the problem patient in a Norwegian setting, but I don't really know. So in the future, perhaps you could, you know, for Japanese readers, you could elaborate upon potential tensions or, you know, something that's implicit there. Mm. But anyway, this Swedish woman appears very interesting because she, at the very beginning, she looks almost dumb. discussing the medication that she's taking as something like a carrot, you know, something organic, is something that's good for you. So you kind of wonder, well, what's this woman doing in this first world, you know, medical setting? and then you have such a wonderful way of describing her, so that, and you also use your ignorance and naivete about the medical profession to your benefit, I think, to a very good effect, because then ignorance often produces this very generative, productive moments in which, you know, you uncover implicit assumptions that everybody thought would be taken for granted, and yet, you know, when you uncover it, it actually is not so certain anymore. So, you know, you sort of like, you identify with this Swedish woman's ignorance, and you discover the meaning of biologics and the organic and the biological together with her. And what's fascinating is the fact that even though at first she appears very idiosyncratic and very idiotic almost, as you hear the nurse's explanation and as you encounter the doctor explaining what it is to her, you begin to kind of realize that, wait, maybe she's not so stupid. Maybe her understanding is actually a reflection of this very particular term that's been introduced to biomedicine. And maybe it's a reflection of the fact that pills are poisons as well. It's something unnatural, something artificial, in that it's been cultured, and that we're taking something poisonous into our body as a way of healing ourselves, which ties into our fundamental discomfort with biomedicine itself. So it's a very clever way that you address those things through the, not just teasing out the semiotics and the local understandings and conceptualizations of the bio through this patient's narratives, but also unpacking the meaning of the bio and biology by tracing the history of the making of this pharma in the later chapters. So one article that I really love to see is the one in which you juxtapose those two levels, so that you begin to show that it's not just the patient's ignorance, but it's actually a very confused history of the pharma that we're dealing with here, and that there are many layers of uncertainty that are being masked as a form of evidence, as a form of established solid scientific knowledge. So it's the beautiful historical unpacking that you do so well here that I'm really impressed with. At the same time, though, I wanted to get more information about local conceptualization of the body and local conceptualization of the pharma or the pills or medicine. Because here I'm introducing my own experience of having worked in Japanese psychiatry and realizing how much of people's understandings about the body, about the psyche, actually have roots in the 17th century traditional medicine, and that these idioms are interwoven and have been incorporated and appropriated and translated into biomedicine in unexpected ways. But you do see historical undercurrents if you actually dig into those. So what you have done is to describe the patient's understandings, you know, in practice, and you do this beautifully. And you also juxtapose that with the biomedical understandings of the biological through the historicization of the medical discourse and medical ideas. But what you don't really do is to historicize more in depth the local patient's understandings of the meaning of the bio. And I was wondering if you might have something to say about that. So can I just throw that at you?
You can. I think it's a very good and very interesting question, and I'm not sure if I can answer anything to it at all. But because what you're saying is that in this discussion, where I show how one patient thinks about medicines, I have showed the history of the medical knowledge she's in dialogue with. but she also comes with there are also like local Norwegian understandings of what the body is, and that's I think this is a acute attack of home blindness. I think it's very difficult to say something about it, and I haven't looked into it, probably because so it's basically a question about what is. Yeah. On the one hand, it's a question about what is. How does Norwegians or people here perceive or live their bodies and their health? And that's really something I don't know.
Okay.
But there's also, and that I would have to kind of find ways to to attack and to find. I could talk about my own body, but that wouldn't be so interesting. and then, but then there's also this. I see a different thing here that I also could integrate more, and that's kind of the. Which I think I touched upon it a little bit, but it's a history of like Norwegian folk medicine and conceptions of health and what kind of how does both this person's and this science relate not only to this cosmopolitan science that has arrived at this local place, but also how does it relate to indigenous traditions of of knowledge, medicine, curing, and to see if there are special things about how the body and health and medicine have been construed in the Norwegian context that also comes into expression in this dialogue between these three persons.
Exactly, especially given how, you know, what a wonderful job you've done to recreate Basu's world, and then you do justice to the richness of the ideas about the body among the new Guineas. So you could do the same thing with Norwegians, perhaps, and introduce some of the literature from the anthropology of Norway. And I think that would be really fascinating for global readers.
Yes.
And it also you talk about the work of Kuriyama, Shigehisa Kuriyama, who's one of my mentors, and he teaches at Harvard, and he's an amazing person who does studies of a history of ancient Greek and Chinese medicine. So there are not very many people who do that kind of work, but you draw on his work. So that's exactly the kind of perspective that I love to see. In the discussion about the nature-culture boundaries in Norwegian conceptualization of the body. So something like that, I mean, if you could incorporate something like that in this article, I think it would be a very powerful article for general cultural anthropological audience. So that's my first point. And the second the second point has to do with medical communication. And here, let me just be very brief and just ask you, what you think is the difference between your work and the previous works that have been done in this field? And here I'm thinking particularly about Arthur Kleinman's work about patient's perspective, patient's point of view versus doctor's point of view. And, you know, it's just a matter of creating those different, I mean, introducing these different points of views. And that's what medical anthropologists do. I mean, this is from the 1980s, so he's moved on from that. But I wanted to articulate exactly how your study differs because you're doing this in 2017.
As I know Arthur Kleinman's work about this, it was very Arthur Kleinman is a psychiatrist and anthropologist at Harvard, and in the late 1980s, or around that time, if he didn't come up with it, it was very important in kind of establishing patient perspectives, mm-hmm. and especially illness narratives, as the narratives that patients construct to make sense of their mm-hmm. illness experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I can't. Who Eisenman? Who did this illness disease comparison? Could somebody help me out?
Eisenberg,
thank you. Already in the 70s. I think it's kind of a similar thing that Eisenberg and Kleinman does, mm-hmm. because what they both do is they manage to say to health professional basically mm-hmm. that there is more to your patients than medical science can account for.
Mm-hmm.
So Eisenberg says that if you can call what you write about diseases, then we can also say that patients have illnesses. And Kleinman says that you have the science, but there are also the perspective of the patients and their narratives. And that's something we can study, and that's something we really should study, so mm-hmm. that we can understand better the condition of the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do is that I think that this has been very useful to open up for physicians, to make also physicians like Kleinman is able to speak about something
yes.
that's not the biomedical thing,
mm-hmm.
And for him as a physician, he can move freely between those two
right.
things.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find is that although that's very helpful for him and for physicians to open up for something more, it also serves to close something for those who are not physicians. So I thought that for me as an anthropologist, for instance, it's if I choose to kind of just speak of patient illness narratives, then I kind of... This all other medical
mm-hmm.
thing that I cannot speak about,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore I thought that one moment. It's this medical thing that I can. Yes, so what I have done is I have insisted on putting patients and doctors and myself on equal footing.
I see.
And that's so throughout the text I use, and this is kind of a bit poetic, you can say, but I use Kleinman's, I quote Kleinman illness narratives when I speak of the doctors
yes.
To kind of show that... It's not so different, and kind of open up that thing, and that does not mean that I do not appreciate what Eisenberg and mm-hmm. Kleinman has done. It's mm-hmm. it's more that I think that it opened up a field by closing one small door,
right.
and perhaps now we can try to open that door as well.
I see. Excellent. I think your focus on the patient is very effective, and it comes out very clearly. And I think you're also incorporating Byron Good's notion of semiotic analysis into the sort of patient's explanatory model, because you're dealing with different notions of the bio, you know, the bio as danger, bio as health, and then showing how those different imageries come into play in medical communication. So that's one of the things that I was really struck by. Another thing is that I think Freud mentioned this, that you really go beyond the traditional medical communication studies in the sense that you're not dealing with communication as something that's received, information is received mm-hmm. by the patient and given by the medical professional who has certainty and authority and legitimacy. You really try to sort of destabilize those dynamics by showing how it's not that the information is pre pre-given that it's pre-existing, but it's always being enacted and created. So the world making is happening in both places, and that medical professionals are also dealing with so many layers of uncertainties. So I think that's another aspect that you bring in. And also another point that I was really struck by was the fact that you are talking about how information is given by medical professionals to patients as if it were drugs, right? I mean, this is one of the very striking original points you make. And it is true, even though medical professionals talk about open communication and so on, they do. I mean, as you beautifully demonstrate, give information in a way that they think it's in the right amount, in the right dosage, and so on. And it's never this sort of democratic notion of communication that you encounter in medical settings, for often for patients' benefit, perhaps. But that model of communication is now problematic, given the fact that if you access the internet, there's tons and tons of information that the patients can access and be on almost equal footing with physicians. So it's almost like the physicians and the medical professionals are living in this illusory world where they think they still have the monopoly of medical knowledge. And that's the tension that you describe in the later chapters.
Yes.
So I think those things can really be brought together to create one article about medical communication and how you have gone beyond the pre-existing literature. Okay, the third point that I wanted to ask, and this might be the most problematic actually, is, and then it ties in with the discussion that went on between you, Freud, and in you, about the anthropology of scientific knowledge production. This is the most radical claim you're making. And having come from the studies of psychiatry, and having seen so many similarities between psychiatry and rheumatology, as you describe it, I'm perfectly convinced that the claims that you're making here, that there are many uncertainties about rheumatologies, and that it's not as scientific as we think it is, and that there are many ways in which the scientific mechanism of falsification, you know, does not quite work, so that they keep reproducing their beliefs despite the evidence to the contrary. So this is what's been discussed again and again in psychiatry. Psychiatrists know this, and you know, this is what anthropologists, psychiatrists like myself have been doing. And I've always suspected that the same might be the case in other expertise, other disciplines, other specialties, because I have quite a few MD PhDs in my seminar, and they come from all kinds of disciplines, and they talk about this all the time, how ambiguous, how uncertain their knowledge is. And yet there isn't the same kind of scientific, social scientific scrutiny about the process of their knowledge making. So you do this beautifully, and the fact that it's done in rheumatology is just wonderful. So I think this can potentially be a very strong paper that should be really known globally. But at the same time, partly because the claims you're making could be seen as radical, especially by doctors who work in rheumatology. I also got the sense, as Freud said, about the lack of in-depth investigation about the working of the rheumatologists themselves. You get a lot from the nurses' perspectives. You get a lot from about the knowledge in action as it is being created in everyday clinical practice. And you also have fascinating discussion about evidence. You know, what counts as evidence, how it is produced, and what kind of dubious evidence is at work, and so on. But so there's something there, and you do cite some rheumatologists who make similar claims about the uncertainty of their own knowledge. But the data simply is not there. It's just not sufficient enough to persuade the readers about the uncertainty of rheumatological knowledge. People might argue that this is a particular unit in which evidence-based medicine wasn't practiced as it should be. Some may argue that this is simply malpractice, that rheumatology isn't this unscientific. So I'm just wondering how you can go about fixing this problem when you do publish so that you can either make a bold claim about the uncertain nature of rheumatology, or maybe back up a little bit to create a safer argument.
What I have been trying to do is which is also what is reflected in the title of my thesis when I've chosen to talk about rheumatology is in the making.
Yes.
In plural. What all the time during this fieldwork, I've felt this, that there is so little I know. And I've been... So the arguments I've been making, I've tried all the time to think that these are... Because what you're saying now is it's basically a question about generalizability.
Exactly.
Right? It's difficult to talk about that like on for all the statements I come with, because I think some are that concerns the drugs, for instance, clearly are valid to interesting for a lot of people many places, while the practice at this hospital is at this hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've been thinking all the time is that all I can do is to describe this part of reality that I see as good as I can, and then it must be up to the others to say if that reflects something they see elsewhere, both different hospitals in Norway, different medical specialties or rheumatology elsewhere. And so that's one way I would approach it. It's really to say that this is just a story about this place, but it may well be that it resounds with your knowledge about other places elsewhere. And then it's a your question about not making such a strong claim. And that may also be wise, I guess. As I say, this thesis is just like the doctors and the patients don't know everything, I don't. So this is my attempt to grasp this part of these things, and it's only part of my attempt at grasping it, because I had to present this in quite short form, only 400 pages. But my supervisors will know that it was 900 pages, I think, before I started cutting it down. And in that process, I've been thinking that if somebody really wants to know what's going on in rheumatology and they really have a stake in it, they won't only come to my book and to find the entire account there. They will see this, they will get information from other places as well. And then so what other information is there? And there's a lot of information, and a lot of it is this very smooth accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And there are communication departments at a hospital, mm-hmm. and it's in the it's like a lot of other accounts out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I initially planned to kind of have that also in here, and to also tell like the good stories, for instance, about the very good research they do there. That can it's government funded; it cannot be privately funded, and it's they're able to kind of do a thing that shows that gives a very different kind of evidence now than they had before, and all these things. But in the end, I was thinking that there are so many stories that's not out there,
mm-hmm.
That I'm able to tell, and I need to focus on those things. And then, therefore, it's not I don't take all this. I don't say all the time, but it's also. And I think that's okay, because I don't pretend to say this is the whole truth. And I don't pretend to say that the cases I study are typical even. I just say that given that there is this very smooth account about what science and medicine and rheumatology is, I went to hospital and I saw that this happened. And this point is something that means that there must be other realities.
I see.
Also beyond that case.
I see. For me, though, the best audience, the most receptive and engaging audience has been psychiatrists themselves.
Yeah.
They invite me to their department conferences and I give, you know, lectures, and they just love it when they're criticized. And, you know, I feel like an entertainer because they can't get enough of it. And and psychiatrists are often very critical to begin with. And, I mean, especially the older ones lament the fact that they used to do this all the time themselves, and now they don't have the time to do it anymore. So it's something that they feel themselves, that, you know, at the everyday clinical level, and yet they don't have the time to reflect on and discuss. So if an anthropologist comes along and points to the discomfort they're feeling, the structural injustice that they're living, then I think they really appreciate it. So, but I think in order to do that, I wonder if it might not be helpful for you to also present the parts where things are going well. And, you know, where EBM, evidence-based medicine, does work, how it has transformed the practice for the better, how it's made things more accessible for patients as well, and then show where it does not quite work the way it was intended to, and then ask why. And it, partly, I think it might be beneficial for you as well to sort of try to get at and describe the struggles that they themselves go through. So that you can begin to think with them rather than just looking at them from outside. And I think this is sort of the point that Freud was making as well, that, you know, where's the drama? We have patients' drama, but there's not enough clinicians' drama. And, you know, that's the stuff of everyday clinical practice. They always question, and that they wouldn't want to go against evidence if they didn't have to. And yet for the sake of treatment, you know, they have to. So, I mean, you show some of this, but it might be interesting to sort of go back to the 900 pages and tease out where things do work, and then, you know, show where things don't work, and then analyze that at a different level, if it's just the failure of person's imagination, or if it's more of a structural constraint, you know, what kind of blind spot is it? Is it more collective? Is it historical? Is it... So I think it's all in there, just that you have to kind of tease it out a bit more for the clinicians to feel understood so that they can begin to engage with it. Because I think there's so much in this that they would want to engage with. Yeah. So think about that.
I think it may very well be that it's the same situation. Well, psychiatrists are psychiatrists, after all.
I know. They're used to being criticized.
So. And rheumatology is first I have to say that this entire project for me, it was an attempt really to... At the same time, when I got this position, I had decided that I would stop my job and go back to medical school because I was very interested in medicine. And then I got this one, and then, okay, let's go for this. And I really wanted to take part in that knowledge thing. So my project really was about trying to find a way to really be in dialogue with this. And then what happened was that the head of the department, who had not talked to me, and was not very well informed, it seemed, decided to close down the study. And I tried to re-establish good contact with that because this produced a lot of ethical and methodological problems. Among other things, it made it impossible to kind of go in dialogue because I had planned really to do my research and not talk too much about what I observed, but then go back, do interviews, enter in dialogue with these people and really try to to forge common understandings and really make this bridge between medicine and social science. And then I have been left to write this on my own, but still I think it's very interesting. I could try and go back and see what kind of dialogue can be created now.
I mean, that's what I sensed. I was reading it, and from the very beginning, it's there's sort of a sense of aloofness, playfulness from the beginning, and it just reads wonderfully, and it's improvised in so many levels that you feel like you're sort of in the presence of wonderful jazz musician who knows how to improvise. Because in order to improvise, you really have to know the structure. You really have to have in-depth knowledge, and you do that so well. And then as I was reading, towards the end of the thesis, and I began to realize what a difficult, incredibly difficult situation you're working in. And I can imagine, because I've done field work in different settings, and there's so many constraints, so many antagonism, not because of you, but what had happened before. And, given the sort of dilemma of the ethical clearance and all these things that we had to go through, and you produce such a beautiful thesis based upon such, I must say, a short field work. And I always make an argument that anthropologists need more than 3 years to finish, because we have to spend like at least a year in the field, and this is like a testimony against that. So you do it so well. So I appreciated the fact that you left out all that bitterness, that sort of emotional agony until the end. And you didn't sort of draw us into that at the beginning. So you let us enjoy the thesis, and then showed at the very last minute how difficult it all was. Which sort of goes to my very first comment and the last question that I have, which has to do with the ethical issues. When I was reading it, especially the introduction, I was a little stunned by the very elaborate description you were making about how important it is to be ethical, how important it is to respect the privacy of the people, and how you went at length of protecting that by creating anonymity, by creating fictional characters, by combining different people into one, so that nobody can be identified in the end. And I believe you did this. But at the same time, because you have those pictures of nurses and doctors for each chapter, and you do such an amazing job of describing what happens on a daily basis, and you begin to identify with those nurses and so on, that I kind of forgot about the fictionality aspect of it towards the end. And I began to kind of like worry for the nurses, because I wondered if it might not lead to some ethical questions there. And so I don't know how much fictionality is in here, how much reality, but I kind of wondered if you had a chance to show this to the natives themselves and what they said and how protected they feel, because it's a difficult issue we medical anthropologists deal with.
Yes.
It doesn't lessen in any way the value of this thesis, but when you're writing a book, it might be something to think about.
Yeah. This thing about safeguarding the participants' privacy, that's been without doubt the most difficult part of writing this thesis. And that comes also away from this situation where the department had decided that the study should stop, and I was instructed not to go back. And where I found that either I managed to re-establish a good connection with the department head, which I gave up after 1.5 years, or I cannot go to the others, because I felt that would be unclean, because they are in a, either they are his employees or they are his patients. And I thought, if I go back there and try to continue these studies without his approval, this was not, will not be tidy. And then I was left with the problem, what then to do with these sensibilities? Because I think ethics is also about, not just about not writing, but it's also about when sometimes there is something you need to write.
Yeah.
And from this fieldwork, there are really things that I felt that, okay, I have no strings attached and I can write a different story than anybody else, apparently. So I need to write these things, and then I need to do whatever I can to anonymize.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end, I also need to kind of think what, to think that I don't carry all the responsibility alone here. There's also the head of the department,
mm-hmm.
Who has some responsibility here in making sure that his patients and employees are taken care of.
Yeah.
But what I did, it was really to then try to anonymize. And what I'm saying, or what you're saying, is that you started to believe that it was not anonymized. Of course, it's really difficult to say when do you recognize yourself and when don't you do it,
mm.
and things like that. But I think I've done a very good job at this. But I did perhaps a bit unconventional choice of saying this in the beginning, but then writing the entire thing without pointing out again that this is this person and that person.
Okay.
And I thought, because I wanted so much to make this anonymous,
mm-hmm.
and to safeguard their privacy, I thought it's better if I fool the reader into believing that they recognize somebody else.
I see.
Than that they actually, or not somebody else, but that it's really... so I've done a lot of things. Not, yeah, somebody else is to say, say wrong. But I, the point I take away from what you're saying is that if or when I'm going to work with this text further...
Yeah. And I hope you will.
Thank you. I now have the opportunity, because it's also been a question about protecting my own ability to work with these things.
That's right.
So I need the distance.
Mm-hmm.
But now I have the opportunity to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And before I can really have those dialogues I wanted to have and see, what do you think about this? Is this...
Yes.
And take out then whatever things may be really making somebody vulnerable or feel offended or whatever
exactly.
it might be.
Exactly. Now, I think it would produce a very reflexive document if you could incorporate that as well. I mean, their responses.
Yeah.
And then what you do with it. Because it's something that we all have to struggle with.
Mm.
So it will be very instructive for all of us.
Yes.
Yes. Last comment that I'd like to make is the fact that, you know, when you're writing this as a book or when you're writing this as articles, you would probably be asked to engage more with the pre-existing literature.
Yes.
I just love the way it's written. It reads very beautifully. And the fact that you didn't so fully engage with, you know, past literature in medical anthropology actually has worked to your advantage in the sense that you were able to create something very unique and extremely original. And we all agree that it's a success. But when you submit it to a journal, you will be asked to write more conventionally.
Mm.
And then I really want you to think very carefully about what communities of scholar you want to be engaging with. You know, what kind of people that you want to be in conversation with. And then tease out what they've done. Because there are lots of people who've thought about similar things,
mm.
you know, who've worked on similar settings, who would really welcome your perspectives. So I think from now on, I would like you to sort of try to engage and find that body of literature, community of people that who would really appreciate this. And I hope I'll be included in this because I've been telling all my friends about what a fascinating dissertation I've just read. And I know there are many medical anthropologists who appreciate this. So I hope you incorporate them in your future work and engage with them. So that's my comments and questions.
Men jeg må bare låne mikrofonen litt. So I would like to thank the second opponent and the candidate for their words. Would the candidate like to make any closing remarks?
Yes, please. First, I would like to thank the Vice Dean as representative for the Faculty of Social Sciences. For the opportunity that I have got to do the work that led to this thesis and to defend it today. I also want to thank the members of the committee, Professor Frode Fadnes Jacobsen, Professor Junko Kitanaka, and Professor Paul Wenzel Geisler for having read and evaluated the thesis and given me so generous feedback and a lot of good comments that I can take with me further. I also want to thank my supervisor. I actually want to start with Arne Kalland, the late Arne Kalland, who supervised me for my master thesis, and then Rune Flicke and Halvar Vike. Thank you so much for training me as an anthropologist. Finally, I want to thank friends and family for invaluable support. Thank you very much.
So the defense is hereby closed, and the rector of the University of Oslo and the University Board will be notified. And then on behalf of the Faculty of Social Sciences, I would like to give you a gift. So since I have this terribly long gown, I would like you to come down so I don't fall.
There are different sizes, and the one I got was not for me.